of us online at thrivent.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's sometimes referred to as one of the first real estate transactions ever recorded. It happened in the Holy Land some 4,000 years ago. A man called Abraham put down 400 silver shekels to buy a grave for his wife. The Bible records it this way. And Sarah died in Kiriat Arba, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham stood up from before his dead and spake unto the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. This past weekend, the tradition of burying the dead continued in Hebron, as did the fight for the land surrounding the tomb of the patriarchs. Today on The Connection, a look at the history of this city. Once an example of religious coexistence, Hebron is now home to some of the worst hatred in the Middle East. Connection listeners, what does the history of Hebron teach us about the prospects for peace between Israelis and Palestinians? Is there any way the dispute over land or the push for peace can work on a city-by-city basis? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, who will take us through the history, is the head of the Paris Center for Peace. Ron Pundak was intimately involved with the negotiations that led to and then followed from the Oslo Accords. He's joining us today from a studio in Tel Aviv. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you there?
I'm fine, and I'm glad that you're with us. I wonder if I can begin by asking you to give us a picture that we can put into our imagination. Just the very idea that there's this city of 150,000 Palestinians with 450 settlers living in the center of it. How do they live? Can you describe that for us?
Yes, actually, it's a quite awkward situation. One should admit, Hebron is a Muslim, traditionally Muslim Palestinian city. Very, very congested, very, very enormously inhabited. There is an old city, which is called the Kasbah, very, very small alleys. And adjacent to the old city, actually, it's in the middle of the city, but quite close to its margin. There are a few homes renovated in which Israeli Jews are living. Now, Hebron, or the Jewish, actually, neighborhoods are divided into two. As you mentioned, around 400 Jews are living in Hebron. But just adjacent to Hebron, around 1 kilometer out of Hebron, we have a small Jewish city, Israeli city, by the name of Kiryat Arba, which is much more modern. It's only a Jewish, and it's a settlement which was created post-67 war. As part of the whole idea of a Jewish-Israeli settlement within the West Bank and Gaza. But going back to the city of Hebron, the city of Hebron, as a result of the different, and maybe we'll speak about it later, as a result of the different agreements between Israel and the Palestinians, was divided into two areas, what we call Age 1, Hebron 1, and Age 2. Hebron 1 is the biggest part in which the Palestinian Authority are running, or used to do it until the last Israeli incursions into the city. And the other part, with a couple of tens of thousands, are under Israeli security, mainly in order to protect the Jewish 400 strong settlers within the city.
Now, and those 400 people there, Ron, do they live behind tall walls, behind barbed wire? Are there lots of soldiers there to protect them?
So the answer is absolutely yes. Hebron is very, very colorful city. It's a very lively city. It has always been a very, very commercial city. The Jewish neighborhoods, or the Jewish houses, because some of them just are spread near the old city, are all barbed fenced with very, very strong positions of Israeli soldiers. And in some time when the Israeli Jewish processions are taking place, whether it is in Jewish holidays, etc., some of the areas of Arab Hebron are being totally curfewed in order to allow the Jews to do whatever the inhabitants are doing there. And clearly what we have is a very, very serious friction. It goes even worse in areas in which some of the Jewish settlers would like to continue and inhabit. Then we have areas in which actually the Jews and the Muslims, so the Israelis and the Palestinians, are fighting. Actually, they're not fighting because there is army to prevent it, but there's a lot of friction also on a daily basis, whether it is in a road which is named the Shuhada Road, which is connecting between the Jewish area within Hebron and some of the Palestinian areas. There used to be a market which now is almost non-existent because of this kind of frictions. So you have here a very, very, very extreme situation in which two groups of both people and individuals and nationals, etc., are meeting each other on a daily conflict. And when I say meeting each other, it is not actually a meeting point, because there's almost no relations between these two communities. But the 400 are feeling owners of the area, and in a way I would say that the majority out of the 400 would have liked to wake up one morning seeing the Israeli IDF expelling the 150,000 out of the city. So we have here a very, very extreme situation of a lot of hatred. And unfortunately, what we have is that we have the very, very strong fundamentalists among the Jews and among the Palestinians who are living in this area, which creates even a bigger point of conflict, friction, and the ability of explosion.
If we go back in history, though, how far do we have to go back to a time when Hebron was this example of coexistence with Jews and Christians and Muslims living together in at least relative peace?
Well, I think that we must go something like around 70 years and even more into the beginning of the 20th century. There was a Jewish population within Hebron, whether it was under the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman are the Turks of today. The Ottomans were running the area until the Brits invaded Palestine in 1917. So during the Ottoman period and later during the first 10 or 15 years of the British mandate in Palestine, around the year until 1928-1929, the two sides were living under the British administration quite well. In 1929, as a result of tensions all around Palestine between Jews and Palestinians, when the beginning of the Jewish Zionist activity started to take place in Palestine, and the Palestinians started to feel that they are being pushed by the Zionist movement and the Jews, and conflict started to be created in Palestine. Tension also erupted in Hebron, and a tragic thing happened in 1929 when some few tens of Jews were slaughtered actually during tension which took place specifically in Hebron, but not only in Hebron. Actually, it took place also in areas like Jaffa and Jerusalem. But
there was 60 people were killed in Hebron at the time.
The numbers varies between few dozens and 60. There were another dozens of of Jews which were wounded, and this actually started the period of escalation, eventually leading to the pulling out of all Jews of Hebron around the year 1936 or 1937.
I wonder, Ron, if I can just move ahead at this point. So if we say from 36,
but if I may just mention one very important thing.
Sure.
And this is regarding the slaughter which took place in 1929. The Jewish population was of a few hundred people. Not all of them, as we know, and as you can judge by numbers, were killed. And the majority of them, over two-thirds of the Jews, were actually rescued by Arabs within Hebron, which means that, as you know, we are all human beings. There are better, there are worse. There are people who are more extreme, people who are less extreme. But we know until today many families which actually assisted Jews to take refuge within the homes and protected them by their own hands and courage. And we have families until today which are known that they assisted to rescue Jews in 1929 and wanted also the Jews to continue to live in Hebron.
So we know that there were no Jews living in Hebron from the mid-30s until about the mid-60s. In fact, it was after the Six-Day War when Israel took control of some of this land that the settlers who are now in Hebron went back. I gather they went back posing as tourists, took over a hotel, and then refused to leave. Is that right?
It's very, very accurate. What happened was that around April 68, which is less than a year after Israel occupied the West Bank, and the West Bank was not annexed officially to Israel, and the West Bank is still occupied territories, even according to the Israeli law, a group of Israeli, later to be known settlers, because this was the first activity of the settlement movement before actually it became a movement, entered into an hotel which is named Park Hotel, and they wanted to stay. What they did was very, very wise, you know, like many groups all over the world. They started to lobby the case among, incidentally, both ministers within Labour Party as well as Likud Party. Two to mention, historically well known, is Mr. Yigal Alon, who became later the foreign minister of Israel, and Mr. Menachem Begin, who was at that time minister without portfolio and later to become the prime minister of Israel. And actually, they assisted them to stay, but eventually, because of security, they were pulled out and convinced to leave and to relocate in a military camp. And then a few months later, the same group convinced the Israeli, actually defense forces at that time, but clearly we are speaking about the government, to create a Jewish yeshiva, which for those listeners who don't know, this is the highest, so to say, academic level of Jewish studies. And in August 68, actually, what we had was the first yeshiva, which until today is working. And when we are speaking about around 400, 500 Israelis in Hebron, one should add to this number also a few hundreds of yeshiva students which are not living in Hebron, but actually are as part of the yeshiva within Hebron. And then later, some months later, Kiryat Arba, which I mentioned earlier, which is an Israeli settlement out of Hebron, but which has a very strong link with Hebron, and today we have around 6,000 or 7,000 people living there. In 68, Kiryat Arba was created. And then there was a small, a short lull. And in the 70s, we still saw beginning of activities, which actually, to sum it up, in 79, we have another wave, and in 84, another wave. All is leading to the situation of today in which we
Ron,
have...
I'm going to stop you there because we have to take a short break. We'll come back and continue the story of Hebron when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What does the history of this one city teach us about the prospects for peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connect. You're You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about Hebron, the history of the city, and what it tells us about the current situation in the Middle East. With me on the program, Ron Pundak. He's Director General of the Peres Center for Peace, also a contributor to the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot as well. Ron, I wonder if I can get you to begin by telling us about the contrast that exists in terms of the way that the settlers in Hebron are seen. When they set up there back in the late 1960s, they were the vanguard. They were admired for their courage by Israelis for going into the center of this city. But they're not that well loved by Israelis anymore, are they?
To speak about Israelis today, it's quite difficult because, like any society, we are not so homogenic.
Yes,
so it's true to say that today the majority of the Israeli population, and when I say majority, I think that one can speak about 70 or 75% of Israelis, are a bit fed up of the situation in which a group of settlers, ideological as they are, and patriots as they are, and true believers as they are, at the end of the day, people are starting to feel that they are dictating the agenda, and in many ways they are kidnapping an agenda for the rest of the Israeli inhabitants. And what we have today is a situation in which more and more people are saying very vocally that they prefer to see a peace with the Palestinians without an Israeli settlement within Hebron, and definitely not with these kind of settlers in Hebron, who are very extreme, very arrogant, to some extent, I would say even, and here I hope I'm not exaggerating, But in an understatement, I will say people who think that they are better than their neighbors. These are things that cannot be tolerated by the majority of Israelis who would like to see eventually peace with the Palestinians, even on with the expense and with the price of pulling out of areas like Hebron, in spite of the fact that we as Jews, as Israelis, including myself, who belongs to a different political camp and has all the respect to these places in regards to our tradition, our history, but still believe that that although Hebron is part of the heritage of my history, is part of the narrative of my people, still we believe, majority of us, that if we would like to live in peace with the Palestinians, it can be and probably it should be without an Israeli presence in Hebron, unless it will be under Palestinian sovereignty and accepted by the Palestinian people.
Who are the settlers who are there now? Are they from all over the world? And what is it about them that makes them in some way different from the Israelis who you say are getting a little tired of their tactics?
Again, I don't want to generalize. It's always very difficult to generalize in regards to a group of some 400, 500 people.
Are they mainly foreigners? Are there a lot of Americans there?
But first of all, I mean, all of them are Israeli Jews. However, there are many who originally have come from other places, mainly United States and France.
Right.
And it attracts somehow a group of people who are very, very extreme. It's not necessarily in the level of the religion, but it is more in the level of the zero tolerance towards the neighbors, towards the idea of coexistence, towards the idea that that this city, actually with a majority of 130, 40 or 50,000 Muslims, Palestinians, and it attracts actually more and more extremists, which to some extent one can say are looking for conflicts, in many ways are provoking conflicts, and in some cases, what we saw is that our own citizens there are not only entering into conflicts with the locals, with the Palestinians, but to some extent are also attacking Israeli policemen who are there to keep public order, or even Israeli IDF people who are there mainly in order to keep the security of the settlers. And what we see is that whenever the settlers feel that the IDF doesn't do what the settlers want, and not necessarily they have a same agenda or interest, then they are attacking, whether it is verbally and sometimes even in more brutal ways. We saw cases of spitting against soldiers, attacking soldiers, calling Israeli soldiers who are keeping their security Nazis and things like this. So we're speaking about a community which is very extreme and, I must admit, very problematic.
And of course, the flip side is that they are living in a situation which is becoming more explosive, because Hebron has become home to a number of Hamas extremists. Islamic Jihad is also there. We know that from the attack on the soldiers and the settlers from last Friday. That, as you describe the settlers in an extreme way, so their neighbors are also becoming somewhat more extreme, no?
I would say that Hebron has always been a stronghold of extremism, also on the Palestinian side, mainly of extremism which belongs to the Muslim different groups and different terrorist groups, whether it is the Hamas or whether it is the Jihad Islami. And the last Jihad Islami, the latter, was also behind the military attack against the group of Israeli soldiers and the security people, which were attacked, were ambushed, and eventually it ended with the killing of around 12 Israelis, most of them policemen, security people, and soldiers. Hebron also, as a society, is a very traditional and very Muslim society. And we must remember that we have in Hebron itself one of the most holiest places, both for Judaism and for Islam. And you started with your program rightly with the fact that around 4,000 years ago, Abraham, which is the father of the two religions, both the Judaism and Muslims, actually bought a piece of land and buried his wife Sarah, who was the mother, according to our tradition and our religion, according to their tradition and their religion, who was the mother of Isaac, who was the second father of Judaism, and was the father of Ismail, who was the father of the Muslims. And here we have actually a source of problem which also belongs to narratives. It belongs to places. And the tomb of the patriarch in which Abraham is being buried, and Isaac and Jacob, according to the Jewish tradition, and Sarah and other mothers, as we call them from our history, is as important for us Jews as it is important for the Muslims. In the past, until the 13th century, Muslims didn't allow Jews to come and pray. Now, after we took Israel place under its responsibility as a result of the occupation of 67, there is a division within the place in which some days the Palestinians, Muslims can pray, some days the Jews, but to be frank, because it is under Israeli occupation, because it is within the compound of the Jewish area, because it is under the H2 area, which is under Israeli military responsibility, there is clearly within the Palestinian point of view, and maybe also within other objective point of view, there is more room and more place for the Jews, which also create a lot of tension.
Let me just step in there if I can, Ron. We've got a number of callers who want to join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Cambridge, and Hillel is on the line. Hi, Hillel.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
In the interest of historical accuracy, I thought it was interesting that your guest described the 1929 massacre as a result of tensions between Jews and Arabs. I think it's very interesting, in terms of historical accuracy, to point out that the 29 massacre, which Mr. Pundak, I'm sure, is quite aware of, was incited by the chief cleric and political figure in Palestine, whose name was Haj Amin al-Husseini, who circulated false photographs and rumors that the Jews were about to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Consequently, carloads of Arabs were trucked into the city, and those are the people who carried out the massacre. I think it's interesting. I wonder if your guests see any comparison between the 2000 violence that broke out for precisely the same reason, rumors that the Jews were about to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque. And as a matter of fact, I believe that the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility along with Islamic Jihad for the most recent massacre. So there seems to be a continuum here of attack and response here, which seems to be a little one-sided.
Ron?
Yes. First of all, I mean, I think what the listener for Cambridge said about the rumors and the instigation, I mean, it's accurate. Regarding Al-Aqsa, just regarding the latter part, I think it was Al-Quds rather than Al-Aqsa Brigade which took responsibility, and Al-Quds Brigade, which is the Jerusalem in Arabic, are belonging to the Jihad Islamic, and I don't think that the Al-Aqsa Brigade, which are the Fatah people, were neither connected nor took any responsibility. But what I wanted to emphasize is that in the early 20s, the tension, also in 21, definitely in 29, and also later, the tension which Haj Amin al-Husseini, the great Grand Mufti, was exploiting, was a real tension between Jews who came to Palestine in order to create eventually what later to become the state for the Jews versus the Palestinians, which felt that there's no room for Jews in Palestine. So people exploited maybe rumors, etc., but the tension between the two societies was always at that time on the verge of explosion, similarly like the tension, rightly so, which took place in 2000, and you had needed a match to ignite the tension, and the match in year 2000, on the 28th of September 2000, was the fact not that there were rumors that Israel is going to occupy or to demolish the mosque, but the fact that our at that time leader of opposition, Mr. Ariel Sharon, today the Prime Minister of Israel, decided against all advices of all military security apparatuses in Israel to walk into the area of the mosque in order to declare Israel's sovereignty, which created the later day tensions and eventually killing on the mountain of on the Temple Mount, on the Haram al-Sharif, the holy area for Muslims and for Jews.
Ron, let me go back to Hillel if I can. Yeah. Hillel, I'm interested in knowing in your view whether or not the Jewish resident settlers in Hebron have as much right to that land as the Palestinians living there.
Well, I think in terms of aboriginal occupancy or inhabitancy, I certainly think they do. There's no denying that there is a traditional Arab presence in the country. There's also no denying that Jews for centuries, ever since the Islamic conquest of Palestine occurred in the 7th century AD, that Jews have been considered second-class citizens.
In practical terms, how would you make it work? Because
Well, I think it's important to point out that it was a right-wing prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, that actually implemented the Hebron Accords, which allocated over 80% of the city H1 to the Arabic population. And so it's not certainly impossible that all spectrums along the Israeli political scene can affect compromise and a workable solution. Unfortunately, there are...
It's a life within walls, though, that you're describing, isn't it?
Well, it is, you know, but I mean, you can always talk about provocation. I think in March 1965, one can argue that on the Edmund Pettus Bridge from the march from Selma to Montgomery, there was an extremely provocative march accompanied by armed soldiers. But nobody within sound of my voice would say this wasn't justified and this was a provocation that was needed.
Hillel, I'm going to move on, and thank you for your call.
Sure. 1-800-423-8255.
To Boston now, and Yuval is joining us. Hi, Yuval.
Hi, hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I would like to thank Mr. Pundak as well for what I see as a very humanistic and an all-encompassing overview of the history of Hebron. I am an Israeli, and I certainly would like to confirm the fact that there are many Israelis. I hope that, as Mr. Pundak says, it's a majority that are opposed to the presence of the Jews in Hebron, of the Israeli settlers.
What about what Hillel was saying, though, that they have an aboriginal right to their place in that city?
Perhaps, but with the kind of behavior that they have been showing, with the kind of arrogance, and with the amount of violence that was produced by them towards the Palestinians, it's true, by the way, I'll finish that thought. I think that with this kind of behavior, they may be denying themselves that right. It's true that the last attack, that the last act of violence was produced by the Palestinians, if we don't count the recapturing of Hebron by the Israeli army. And it's true that there is extremism, Palestinian extremism in Hebron. But it's also true that the Jewish extremism is being supported by the army. It's a very small minority that is like an elite that can decide for the future of the city, the fate of the city. And I think one of the most memorable violent attacks in the history of Hebron is the one produced in the beginning of the 90s by Baruch Goldstein. It was a massacre done by an Israeli settler in the Tomb of the Ancestors. I feel like this kind of behavior is denying me the ability to live in peace in my country. That as long as this small elite of 450 people are thinking that they have the right to be there and force violence and disrupt the peace of the city just because of their feeling of entitlement, me as an Israeli who wants to live in my country, wants to live within the realm of the Green Line, wants to live in peace, I cannot see a future for the country. I think that applies to many people who live in the territories, but I see in the people of Hebron the epitome of this, because there is so much hatred, so much extremism. A lot of people live in settlements in the Palestinian area, and they don't do it even for a political reason. They are supported by government money. They think of it as an opportunity. They just don't care.
Yuval, I'm going to step in there because we have to go for a break. I want to thank you for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, a little bit about the history of Hebron, to look a little bit at the future of the Middle East and whether or not the depth of the hatred that exists in that city also shows some way out for both sides. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Year to come, and thanks.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, all you have to do is stand in the no man's land that exists between the Jewish settlement, the Israeli settlement in Hebron, and the Palestinian marketplace, and the see the number of soldiers and the lack of communication that exists there, to get a terrific example of the lack of communication that is so much a part of the problem there. Even at the Tomb of the Patriarchs, where the different soldiers and the different ropes can tell you where you can go and which part you can go, and whether or not you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish makes a difference about where you're allowed to go. It is no way to live. 1-800-423-8255. Ron Pundak is my guest. He's been talking to us about the history of Hebron. He's Director General of the Peres Center for Peace. And let's go to a call to Smithfield, North Carolina, and Eunice is on the line. Hi, Eunice.
How you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just want to mention, Dick, something about the your guest. With all due respect to Ron, Ron only can represent his own point of view against the extreme right inside Israel. Now, when we talk about 450 settlers inside...
What are we missing here, Yunus?
You're missing the extreme side of the Israeli society, that they are supported by the Israeli forces. You have 150 Palestinians are under the control of those 450. If a Palestinian does an act against, let's say, a civilian or a settler, okay, he's a terrorist, yes, those extreme people can go in, ransack the streets, burn stores, burn crops, do whatever they want to do by these, and the same thing, the Israelis are monitoring them and watching them. Okay, this is not fair, okay? This is not fair when they told me about the 1929 massacre, when the Palestinians felt threat, okay, of the Jewish settlers under the British occupation.
It's not fair on both sides, though, right,
Yunus? No doubt. Killing, it's not condoned by any means. There's no doubt, okay? But when we talk about fairness, okay, we have to look at 150,000 population,
right.
Okay, controlled by a few people. And those, when we talk about Dick, when we talk about those people, unfortunately, they're coming from other Yankee Jews or Texan Jews or Russian Jews with a Rambo mentality, fully equipped with arms. They are God-chosen people, yet we are not God-chosen people. They can do whatever they feel like it, yet we can't in our own homeland. I am a Palestinian who were expelled in a little town, probably Ron know about it, and probably he doesn't, called Yalu. Yalu was demolished in 1967, okay? Now there is a Canada Park in the state of Yalu. Where are the, 2,000 or 3,000 people who live in that village? They're not there no more.
Let me ask Ron, Yunus, if I can, just to give us a sense from Israel today about how much Hebron stands as a symbol of the same frustration that you're expressing here when it's discussed on both sides. Ron?
Yes, Yunus, hello. Actually, I must admit that sometimes I find myself... saying actually the same sentences which Eunice just expressed. I think that from any point of view, whether it is humanitarian, whether it is national, whether it is in regards to the private individual right, where the fact that 450 Jews are not controlling but actually dictating through the fact that the Israeli army is protecting them, and by this is giving very, very hard life to the 150,000 people of Hebron. This is a problem, and for this reason, I think that the majority of us would like to see one solution to this problem, and this is a end of violence together with end of occupation, together with peace based on reconciliation between the two peoples. Having said this, we, unfortunately, speaking about fairness and justice, we cannot create miracles, and we all, both Yunus and myself, should be governed by realpolitik guidelines and understand, for example, that Yalu, which unfortunately know exactly the history of Yalu and exactly the history of the other two villages near Yalu in what is today Park Canada, what is the area of Latron, this we cannot recreate this place, and I would like to see Eunice coming back to a Palestinian state, but one thing should be very clear to all of us, that even if the Jews of Hebron will be pulled out, still, the security, the safety, the legitimacy of the state of Israel as a state for the Jews in our borders of give or take 67 borders should be kept, should be safeguarded, and should be promoted even by people like Yunus.
May I say something, Dick?
Go ahead.
There's no doubt. I respect your point of view, Ron. When you talk about the borders between the state of Israel and the state of Palestine should be respected in by international law, there's no doubt in my mind that this can be happen. But when you have guys like Sharon and Netanyahu. You know, especially Sharon, those guys that have been in the army. And look at now what Shaul Mufaz is going to do, okay? Those are army generals that they don't know nothing except fire at him because they are extremes or because they are carrying weapons. This is not the mentality that we
Eunice,
need.
Quick last question for you, if I can just get you in on Hebron. It was to be used as any kind of example for the way that peace could work in the Middle East. How could you offer, guarantee, access to people of all religions to the tomb of the patriarchs in a Palestinian city and do it in a way that's safe?
There's no doubt in my mind that it can happen. First of all, you know, the just is a little synopsis. The Palestinians reform from supposedly a PLO revolution to, you know, take all over Palestine to the destruction, basically the state of Israel, now to the two-state solution. The PLO is not there no more, okay? The charter of the PLO is not there no more. We lived in Oslo. We have basically an authority that are willing to sit down with all four countries from the major European countries and the United States to sit down and settle the issue.
Eunice,
we are willing to do it, yet we don't have no chance by the settlers and mentality like Sharon.
Thanks for your call, Eunice. 1-800-423-8255 to Zinovi, who's joining us now from Brookline. Hi, Zinovi.
Hi. Eunice talked about us. I'm a Jew from Russia, and I was in Hebron, and I buried my wisdom tooth in the tomb of the patriarch.
Hmm.
And I also read research that many Arabs in Hebron, they have Jewish blood, so they are kind of converted, kind of like Jews for Jesus, Jews for Allah. So in the old time, they became Muslims, and they cling to the land.
What's your point here, Zinovi?
And my point is that both settlers and the Hebron Arabs call Israeli soldiers of Israeli army, and Nazi soldiers, as we heard on the program. So they have their common enemy, which is Israeli army. Let's imagine that the Israeli army will pull out of Hebron. What's going to happen?
Ron?
Well, first of all, I don't want to see the Israeli army just pulling out without an agreement. The question is whether, and Eunice gave an answer, I'm not so sure that it's a full answer, whether there is a possibility that Israel will pull out of the area of Hebron, not because of pressure of neither the settlers nor the Palestinians there, but as part of an agreement. Then comes the question whether Jews will be allowed both to visit, to access, to enter, to pray, even to live in areas which were Jewish originally before 1936. I would like to see this happening. Unfortunately, my feeling is that it won't happen so soon, and I think we should be ready also to convince or maybe to force the Jews in Hebron, if there will be peace and if there is a Palestinian state living coinciding peacefully with Israel, to leave this area in order to create strong relations which then will allow Jews to come to visit openly, even maybe to live under Palestinian authority and sovereignty.
If we talk about this, Ron, just in terms of the current politics, on this day the Labour Party is going through its primary, and then the man most likely, Mitsnah, to, at least by the polls, to come out in front is talking about dismantling Israeli settlements in Gaza. But the idea of dismantling the settlements in Hebron is not something that actually gets talked about. I mean, so for all you're saying that there's a discomfort with their extremism, perhaps even the fanaticism of the settlers there, it's not something that even the Labour Party wants to talk about at this point.
It's difficult to put it today in very clear points, because I don't think people are speaking in detailed plans in regards to the future. Gaza is very, very clear and easy. We're speaking about around 365 square kilometers, where the Jewish settlements are only 5,000 people. It's not a big deal. One can make a clear-cut situation, and people don't have any special feelings towards Gaza, even, I must admit, the settlers within the West Bank. Speaking about Hebron, which is, you know, the second holiest city for the Jews, with the tomb of the patriarchs, with the extremism, etc., then you are right that people are not necessarily referring to it. Having said this, one should remember that there's no doubt that there is today a majority within the Israeli public who are saying that they are ready, we Israelis are ready, to even pull out unilaterally from the West Bank into a new border which will annex parts of the biggest settlements. Now, if we would like to pull out even unilaterally, which I'm personally not in favor of it, but let's assume that today it's in a way a common denominator among many Israelis, whether Labor or Likud, then you cannot pull out without pulling out from Hebron. I mean, if you'll pull out and leave this wound of Hebron, which can explode in the face of all of us, then it means actually the deep down in the heart of the politicians. And I think also the majority of people understand that there is no peace with an Israeli control in the heart of Hebron.
You know, in those moments over the past 2 years when people have talked about what recipe for peace would work under the current circumstances, there's always the conversation about land for peace and less talk about the cities, the flashpoints. Certainly people say, oh, you know, we're never going to settle Jerusalem, set it aside, we'll worry about what we can manage at the beginning. I'm wondering, just in context of this conversation, when we talk about what Hebron represents and also what Jerusalem represents, whether or not you could start with the cities, whether or not the solutions that might work for the nation could begin in a city which is at least in terms of size manageable.
I tell you, I was involved in many of the discussions, whether they were officially in the past and non-officially in a track two diplomacy with the Palestinians, since Oslo and also in the last few years. My conclusion out of everything is, A, we can make peace with the Palestinians. There's a possibility, and there are two constituencies and even leaderships eventually which might make the peace happening. We need courage. We need the ability to convince both sides one thing, that when we are signing a peace, from the point of view of the Israelis, this is a peace which ends the conflict, which is the last peace, and post-peace we have a peace era. And we need to convince the Palestinians that if we are signing peace, actually it is not an interim thing, it is also its real peace, Israel will pull out, etc. Now, in order to achieve this, we need to do one thing, and this is a comprehensive big deal, a big bang, in which we are not beating around the bush. We are going straightforward to deal with all the very sensitive issues, whether they are refugees, whether it is Jerusalem, whether it's border security, and Hebron falls into actually almost all of the issues. Then I think the Hebron issue, the Jerusalem issue, will fall into place within the larger picture. The two sides need peace. The two sides can reach peace. And I think that if we would like to reach peace, it will be with Hebron as a Palestinian city, sovereign city, and hoping that the Palestinians will be tolerant, wise, and positive to allow us to visit these places.
Ron, otherwise, I have to stop you there.
Otherwise, it will create tension.
Thanks so much for being part of the program today. Ron Pundak is Director General of the Peres Center for Peace. He's also a contributor to the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aronot. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.